Welcome to The Roofer Show with your host, Dave Sullivan. You found the podcast that helps roofing contractors grow their businesses, make more money, and have more free time. Each week, Dave interviews the industry's top experts who will give you actionable tips and strategies for the real world of construction to help you take your roofing business to the next level. So let's get down to business.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to The Roofer Show, the place to be if you want to grow a more profitable roofing business. I'm your host, Dave Sullivan, and I've been a successful roofing contractor for over 30 years, and I'm here to share with you what I've learned. You can get more tips, strategies, and downloads by going to my website at theroofershow.com. Today, I have another great interview about a topic that applies to every contractor and business owner out there. Even in this booming economy, there's still a lot of contractors that are going out of business. In episode number 14, I interviewed business expert Michael Stone, and we talked about the number one reason that contractors fail, and that is because they just don't understand the cost of doing business, and they don't charge enough money for their work. And that's always a slow and painful process unless you get help and make some changes. But these problems, they can be corrected. But there are other dangers out there that can happen like in a blink of an eye, and it's game over. And if you don't prepare, once it happens, there's no going back. And these are what I call the four D's that can kill your business, even though your business is kicking ass and you're making a ton of money. These four D business killers are dissolution, divorce, death, and disability. When they hit, most businesses don't survive. I've got a couple of real-world stories today that I want to discuss with my guest, Scott Calhoun. But before we do, I want to thank our sponsor, Ruby Receptionists. I love these guys because the number one complaint from buyers of home services is that contractors simply just don't answer the phone. But if you're going to run a successful business, you've got to leave a great first impression. Otherwise, all that money you're spending to get the phone to ring, it's just going in the trash. A Forbes magazine survey tells us that 80% of callers won't leave a voicemail. They're just going to call your competitors until they get a live person to pick up. And whether you're using voicemail or you're using one of those terrible answering services, you're losing business. But with Ruby Receptionists, they'll answer 100% of your calls live. They'll transfer only the calls you want to receive, take messages. They address common problems, just like an in-house receptionist, but at a fraction of the cost. So building trust with project owners from the first interaction is critical to earning their business, which is why they do more than simply answering the phone. With Ruby, all your calls are answered by a friendly professional receptionist. Their positive tone and desire to go above and beyond build relationships from day one, and that's increasing the likelihood of you selling that job. Ruby gives you the peace of mind to step away from the phone and focus on the activities that make you money. With real-time updates and notifications, you can stay on top of your calls wherever you are. All your messages and voicemails are at your fingertips through the Ruby mobile app and can be delivered to you via notifications, text, or email. If you want to experience Ruby for yourself, and I suggest you do, just go to callruby.com/roofershow and go for a test drive. You'll set up a sample greeting. They'll email you a temporary number to call, and you can make as many test calls as you want within a 1 hour window. And you can save $50 on your first full month's service by using promo code ROOFER50. That's callruby.com/roofershow or give them a call at 844-326-7829 and start making that first great impression today. Let's get back to our interview with Scott. Scott is an attorney with the law firm Hendrick, Phillips, Salzman, and Siegel out of Atlanta. They were my attorneys for the last 20 years. They only work for contractors, and they really know the construction industry. Scott's got a broad base of experience in the formation and structuring of all types of business entities, as well as mergers and acquisitions. But today I want to tap into Scott's 30 years of experience in helping roofing contractors with succession planning and partnership agreements to help our listeners stay out of trouble and avoid those dreaded 4 D's of business killers. So let's get into it with Scott Calhoun. Hey, Scott, thanks for coming on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Hey, I've been looking forward to having you on because this is such an important issue that I want to talk about. And I've seen so many contractors go out of business, just go under from one of these 4 D's that we want to talk about. And so today, I'd like to talk with you about how we can avoid these disasters. And like so many things in running a construction business, if we don't plan for these things up front, it's too late after it happens. We're going to get into some of these real life horror stories because they're pretty ugly. How does that sound, Scott? Sound like a plan?
Oh, it sounds great. And you've hit on things that I think are really important. That is planning going into it and not just trying to deal with something after it's too late. I have a lot of horror stories in that area, but let's go ahead and get going.
Sounds good. But before we get into this real nasty stuff, I just wanted to start off by either guys that are starting off a new business or we've got an existing business that really should be revisited. So I just wanted to touch on setting up these companies, the type of corporate structure that you recommend. We've got a number of them, and I see so many companies, whether they're LLCs, C-Corps, Subchapter S, but you know, I'm still seeing some sole proprietorships. So what can you tell us briefly about, you know, how a roofing company should be set up and how are we going to start this thing off on a good foot?
Well, that's a great question. And you mentioned you still see some sole proprietorships out there. And first thing I would say is that is the business form to try to avoid as a roofing contractor. As a roofing contractor, you're subject to a lot of potential liability. People can fall, can be damaged from construction work and that kind of thing. And while you have and are going to have insurance, insurance doesn't always cover everything, and you don't want to be in a position where your personal assets are going to be available to creditors who might come after you to sue you or otherwise make a claim to be paid for their injuries or losses. And so a sole proprietorship doesn't help you at all. A general partnership doesn't help you at all in that case. The kinds of entities that do help you are corporations and limited liability companies. And so first thing I recommend is that anybody looking to start a roofing contractor business consider only forming an LLC or a corporation. The difference between the two can get a little bit, we can get a little bit technical about it. At the end of the day, the idea behind both an LLC and a corporation is the same, and that is there's limited liability for the owners. And what that means is that whatever you might have to put into the company as a shareholder to purchase your shares or put into an LLC in order to become a member, that's the only thing, that's the only amount of money that you're going to have at risk. And a creditor will not be able to come after your personal belongings and personal assets. So the key is to make sure that the organization of the entity is done properly at the beginning. So I recommend that anybody looking to set up a business talk to an attorney, make sure they get the company formed properly, and then make sure they do what's necessary on an ongoing basis to keep the company in good shape, in good standing with the state, and also to make sure that you keep all the money separate so that you aren't using the company's assets to pay your personal heating bill or your personal cable bills, and so that you're not just funneling money in and out of one pot without keeping it clear that this is the company's money or that this is your individual money.
I see a lot of that where they're commingling the funds and you get a real chance of piercing the corporate veil.
Yeah, that's correct. And that's what I was talking about, making sure you do what's necessary to keep it in place.
Right.
And so, for instance, one way you can lose the corporate veil is what we've talked about, commingling of funds, not properly separating your money from the company's money. Another way that you can lose the protection of the corporate veil is to not do the proper paperwork. And that includes filing with the Secretary of State or whatever the particular state entity is that that you register your corporations in your particular state. And it also means preparing annual meeting minutes,
right,
and properly documenting transactions that are done by the corporation or the LLC to make sure that that's done separately. And so it isn't just Dave Sullivan out there doing things and saying, well, this is my corporation doing it.
Yeah, it's not something you just go on to LegalZoom and pick up some forms, fill them out, and then throw them in your drawer and never look at them again. It's a lot more complicated than that, and that's what we're going to get into on these business killers, because it gets pretty complicated. You got to have it set up right at the beginning, and you've got to have a good attorney to help you out.
Yeah, and I've seen it, and I've also seen people reluctant to bring an attorney in or even talk to a CPA because they don't want to spend the money. It reminds me of the old was a brake company, I think, you know, pay me now or pay me later.
Right, right.
And a little bit of planning, a little bit of money up front to an attorney who knows what he or she is doing in this area can save you from many, many, many thousands of dollars lost later on.
Let's talk about these four common disasters that hopefully we're not going to have to face, but so many contractors do at some point in their career. And let's talk about some of the practical steps that we can take to prevent or minimize this damage. But the first one is dissolution of the company. Now, this is something I see so often where you've got two partners, start off in business, you know, hey, my buddy or whatever it is, for whatever reason, they're going to go south. One of these partners wants to leave, you get in a big argument. I've been there, and it is just a real mess if you don't have the kind of paperwork set up and the agreements. Can we talk about this where we've got a dissolution of the company, we've got partners that are going to split up? How do we just set this up so we're not going to have these huge headaches and litigation and big mess coming down the road?
Well, Dave, that's a great question, and I've seen so many cases like this where people haven't done what they needed to do up front. And you know, my favorite horror story about this is the time that I had a client call me and said, "Hey, we got a 50-50 shareholder arrangement, but I'm thinking that we ought to have something in place that talks about what happens if somebody leaves." And I said, "It's a great idea. I'm happy to sit down and talk to you." He says, "Okay, I'll give you a call next week." Well, he didn't call me. And then he calls me a year later, and he says, "Hey, do you remember talking to me?" And I said, "Yeah, I remember." And he says, "So you think we can sit down and talk about doing that agreement?" I said, "Sure." I said, "You know, I'm available for lunch, or I can come out to your office." And he said, "Yeah, I think maybe lunch, and I think maybe quick, like tomorrow would be good." I said, "Really?" He says, "Yeah, because my partner came in the other day and said he's leaving." Well, Dave, at this point, it's too late, right? I mean, he should have called me, should have followed up before. And so here's the situation, especially when you got a 50-50 kind of situation, two shareholders, two members of an LLC, and it's 50-50. Just because somebody leaves and starts working somewhere else, first of all, doesn't mean they lose their interest in your company, right? Yeah. So you could have a partner who'd left and start his own business, and he's still entitled to 50% of your business.
Yeah.
Well, that's a nightmare. what are you supposed to pay him when he leaves? How are you going to figure that out? That's a nightmare. And, you know, if you don't have any documentation in place, most states have statutes that say, oh, it's easy. You just go to court and figure it out.
Right.
Well, you know, after you paid all the lawyers and had all the stress of all the litigation and the company's completely gone, there's no money to pay anybody anything.
Yep.
So, you know, that's a serious problem. So what do you do? Well, you address it up front. It's part of the planning process. Okay. And especially in a 50-50 situation, you really need to look at a couple of issues. Number one, what's the situation that's going to cause a trigger? Is it if he leaves? Is it if there's some issue about just not wanting to work together anymore? Now, some of the other D's will talk about other situations, but the real key in those circumstances where you've got just the dissolution, you've got to just to kind of break up is, well, what's the valuation going to be?
Right.
How are you going to, what's going to be the process? And so you put together provisions in a shareholders agreement if it's a corporation, or in your operating agreement if it's an LLC, that addresses these issues. And I have found the really most effective way in a 50-50 situation is to use a provision I call a shootout. It's like the old shootout at the OK Corral.
Mm-hmm.
And the name comes from, you know, you both draw your gun and whoever fires first, right? It's a shootout. Well, in a corporation or an LLC situation where you're looking at a dissolution, a shootout provision is one person goes to the other and says, look, this is not working, or I'm leaving, or I can't stand you anymore, or whatever the particular circumstance is, and says, we just need to go our separate ways for whatever reason. So I'm telling you, Dave, we're going to have to go our separate ways. At that point, you, Dave, get to decide whether you want to buy or sell my interest. And because I come to you and I say, we're going to go to our separate ways, and here's the price, $100. Now, you get to decide, Dave, whether you want me to buy you out for $100 or you want to buy me out for $100. And if, by the way, you just put things off and don't ever do anything about it, then at the end, after a period of time, I get to pick. But most people will pick. And why does that work so well? Because I'm not going to present a number on the table that will not work for me. It won't be a number that's going to be too low, thinking I'm going to buy you out for a low number, because you could buy me out for that.
Right.
It's not my choice. I'm not going to pick a number that's too high, hoping you'll buy me out, because you might decide to sell to me, and then I have to pay you the higher number. So I'm going to think long and hard about what the right number is, and I'm going to present a fair number on the table. And what that does is that forces people to come pretty quickly to a resolution at a fair number, then your dissolution happens. Found that that works really, really well. And even if it isn't ultimately triggered, having it out there as a hammer is often an incentive to force the two parties just to work together to figure out what's the right thing to do.
That was a situation I was in a long time ago. I was 50-50 partners with a family member, and I wanted to take the company in a different direction. But we had a similar agreement to what we're talking about and came up with a fair price. Everybody was relatively happy, relatively little bloodshed. But without that type of agreement, I think you're really screwed.
Well, you are, and trying to get to that agreement ahead of time, doing it up front, is the time when it needs to happen. Mm-hmm. And I've had people who are reluctant to do that. You know, they're saying, well, we're ready to get going. We want to do everything together. We're best friends. We always wanted to do this. There's not going to be any problems. If we start talking about what's it going to be like if we try to split up, that's going to, you know, put a wedge between us. It's going to cause a problem or whatever. But that's the very best time to discuss those things, when in fact you are both rowing the boat the same way, and then you can get to a number, get to a procedure that's going to work, that that you both can agree to, and then you can move on to actually running the business.
I think statistically, most partnerships do end up failing. That for whatever reason, they go their separate ways. This leads to our second D, which is divorce. There seems to be a much higher rate of divorce in running a construction company, I think, because for one, it's so stressful and puts so much stress on the family. The divorce, similar to the disillusion, but usually a lot worse. Whether you have an agreement or not, your spouse is going to have a 50% interest in that company. Next thing you know, she or he says, you know, hey, that's fine. We're divorced, but I don't want to work in this thing, but I want you to write me a check each month, you know, and I'll give you some advice here and there. Nobody wants to take that. It can be a real problem. What do you see in that? And how do we start off? One, along with the disillusion also, is it's certainly easier through, you know, whether it's a prenup or some kind of an agreement, starting off before you start into business. Let's touch on that. But also, now I've got this ongoing company. We're all good friends and so forth. But realistically, statistically, we could have some problems down the road. So let's get this thing dialed in before we do. What can you tell us about that, with the potential of a divorce?
Well, you certainly want to try to address it before you get to the actual divorce kind of situation. And whether you do it up front or whether you get into operating the business and you might have a buy-sell agreement in place, but it doesn't deal with divorce. I see a lot of buy-sell corporate shareholder agreements, LLC operating agreements. They talk about other circumstances, but they don't talk about divorce. And the problem, as you say, is that the non-divorcing partner in the business ends up having to deal with the ex-spouse. And, you know, divorce is hard enough on the married couple to bring in a third person as well. So what do I see? I see agreements that try to have mandatory prenuptial arrangements in place so that the married couple between them agree as to what happens if there's a divorce with respect to the business. There are some problems with relying on that approach. In certain states, prenuptial agreements are harder to enforce than in others. Sometimes the divorce courts overlook them or disregard them if they don't think that people are being treated fairly, if they think there was an unequal bargaining power when the agreement was entered into in the first place. So relying strictly on a prenuptial agreement, I think, is a little risky. I think the other thing, though, that you can do is put in your agreement between the shareholders that essentially says if somebody gets divorced or is in the process of getting divorced, when that divorce proceeding starts, there's a notice given to the other shareholder and there's a buyout. And at that point in time, you know, the money is the money, and the two spouses are going to fight over all of their money. But, you know, they're not fighting over the business. They're fighting over the money that the shareholder in the business received from having to sell his shares because of the divorce.
I think that's a key issue. You're right, because you want to be fighting over the money, not control of that business.
And it can be a real problem, and I don't have to tell you that. Because when you get a divorce situation involved, not only do you have issues over money, but the emotions running in a divorce are such that, you know, if the divorcing spouse is mad at the other spouse, they're going to be mad at everybody that their spouse ever had anything to do with as well. And it's just gonna become like a snowball, growing and growing and growing as it rolls down the hill.
Yeah, and here you are working your ass off, and your partner's going through this divorce. It's just sucking him dry. His focus is not on the business. His mind is just not there. Also, what I've seen, you get into court, they tell you to get your two appraisals, and they're all over the board, totally different. Let's say the judge comes back with a judgment and you're going to owe her or him $200,000. Well, where are you going to get that cash? It's going to come from the business. So you got a real nightmare on your hands, which is why you got to have some kind of plan in place before you get into this.
Well, it can be a real nightmare, because if in that scenario, the judge says pay her $200,000, if you don't have an agreement in place with your co-shareholder and with the company about what happens, and the judge says you got to pay the money, the only place to get the money is from the business. And the only way you're going to get that money out of the business at that point is to sell it. And so now the innocent shareholder, if you will, you know, suffers from all of this too. He's lost his business because you got divorced.
Right.
And you know, that just is a real nightmare scenario for everyone involved.
Well, that's why I call them the 4 D's of business killers, which brings us into the third D, which is death. And frankly, I would choose number 3 over 2 over going the divorce because it's easier. I know a guy whose partner died, and their 5 kids inherited the business. So now this guy's partners with 5 of these kids that have no knowledge of the business. And here he is working his ass off. What can we do to avoid that situation?
Well, I think it's really important to avoid that situation. You know, you say the guy's got 5 kids, you know, 2 of them never have set foot in the business. Don't even know what you do, don't know a difference between a roof shingle and a roofing nail. And yet, you know, each of those 5 kids, they never fails. Each of the 5 kids will have the attitude that they individually are the one that owns 50% of the business.
Right.
So the guy who's remaining ends up not only having to deal with 5 people, but also 5 people who each think they own the other half, not their 20% of the other half, mm-hmm. Right? And so, you know, it's really can get really, really ugly situation. So how do you deal with it? Well, as we've been saying along, you know, the thing to do is have an agreement up front. So what are the options then if somebody dies? Well, you're going to have to deal with valuation. And we've already talked about how valuation is an issue here, all right? So you can either have an agreed value between you. You can have it set up with an appraised value. That's going to cost money. It's going to be a problem. You can have a situation where you agree to a value every year. You sit down at the beginning of the year and say, if something happens this year, this is what we think the company's worth. Mm-hmm. That works really well if you actually sit down and do the valuation and write down the number every year. Inevitably, what happens is that people, even with the people with the best intentions, sit down and do that the first 2 or 3 years, and then things get busy, and they go 3 or 4 years, and they don't do it, and then somebody dies. And now it's been a long time since they sat down and had an agreement on the number, and there could be a lot of different factors now as to why the people, the family of the shareholder who dies thinks it might be worth a lot of money, mm-hmm. because he kept coming home talking about how great the business was doing, when in fact we had a lot of volume, but we also had a lot of really, really tight margins going on, and we had a couple of jobs go bad. And while that created a lot of work, it didn't create a lot of profit and that kind of thing. And so you end up with that situation where if you're going to have an agreed value that's done every year, you really have to do it every year. Mm-hmm. The simplest approach is to get life insurance.
All right, right, exactly.
And to have an idea of how much the life insurance should be for, and just say that when somebody dies, their interest will be bought out for the value of the life insurance. Now, the thing to be concerned about there is making sure that, number one, that you do it at a stage, you have to do it as early as you can to make sure that everybody's going to be insurable.
Mm-hmm. Right.
This is not an approach you can rely on if you've been in business with somebody for 20 years, because one of you may not be insurable,
right,
or at least not affordably insurable. And then the other issue is to make sure you sort of peg the amount of the insurance to what you think's fair for an interest in the company. And then the other issue is if you've got a situation where the company is paying the money out, and you're not relying solely on the insurance, or you don't have insurance in place, then you have to be concerned about when is the money going to be paid to the family, and is it going to be over a period of time, and if so, what stress is that going to put on the cash flow of the business, and in that case, what other mechanisms do you have in place to protect the business so that you don't have such a devastating influence on your cash flow? So whether that's having the payout be 5 or 7 or 10 years as opposed to 3 years, whether it's some mechanism in place where if somebody dies, there's a period of time in which there are no payments until the company can sort of build up some revenue stream, put some other people in place to replace the guy who died, you know, that kind of thing. You've got all of those issues that can put stress on the payments and what it does to the company.
Yeah, there's so many people that don't like talking about their death or preparing for this. And let's say we've got I own 100% of this business, and I die, and this is something that I see a lot of times. And now where you think, oh, well, we've got this business that's worth all this money. Without that owner, all of a sudden everything stopped, and you don't have any succession plan. So how do we kind of avoid that? Because this happens all the time. They never, you know, I'm not going to talk about my death. I'm not going to tell anybody what's going to happen if I die, or talking about bringing people in to run, you know, having your systems and processes in place so the business will continue. You've still got key men, but I see a lot of these companies just die.
Well, they do, because a lot of these companies, as you said before, there's not a lot of inherent value in the business. The business is the man or woman whose name's on the door. Mm-hmm. And their goodwill in the community and their reputation. And so when they die, you know, the business dries up, and especially if they haven't done proper planning to have something in place, you know, the business dies as well. So from a succession planning standpoint, that's a really, really good point, especially someone who's 100% owner of a business, but even in partnerships too. But to do the planning up front, and yes, nobody likes to think about what happens when they die, but you have to. You have to understand what's going to happen and how it's going to happen. And you have to consider, there are a lot of things to lot of factors to consider. You have to consider whether you have family members who have an interest in the business. Mm-hmm. I see a lot of situations where a sole owner or a controlling owner thinks, well, when I retire and then when I die, my son will come in and take over, and the son doesn't want to have anything to do with the business. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a recipe for disaster right there. Other times you have situations where you've got the long-term owner of the business, and he's got a son or daughter who is active in the business, but they don't really think that son or daughter has what it takes. They don't really get it. They don't really see the big picture, whatever. In the meantime, in the last few years, they hired a project manager who really gets it, who really knows what's going on. And the very best thing to do would be to assign the business over, if you will, to set it up so that it succeeds over to the project manager. But that owner doesn't want to deal with that, right? because that's contrary to the family. And the only thing that I can say there is that as an owner, as the longtime person responsible for the business, you have to decide what's important. And if you don't care whether the company continues when you retire or die, then don't plan. Don't worry about it. Right. It doesn't matter. But if you do care about that, if you think there's a legacy, if you think there's something that your family should benefit from in the long run or whatever, then you've got to do that planning. And you've got to do it not just by yourself. You've got to do it in conjunction with your family. And you've got to do it in conjunction with your other advisors, your lawyer, your CPA, your insurance people, whoever else helps you with your estate planning, you know, those kinds of things. You've got to get everybody together, and you've got to talk about it. Right. And you've got to talk about it with that project manager person that may or may not be in line to take over. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't, then it's not going to be a successful succession at the end of the day. And you can't put it off because that won't help. It will only make it worse.
Right, right. I do a lot of business planning with contractors. And the first thing that I always do is start with the end in mind. There's going to be a point where you're no longer going to be in this business. You're either going to retire, you're going to die. Whatever it is, there will be that day. And I always start with that first thing. What's the plan? You want to sell this? You're going to bring your kids in? You want to give it to your employees? Whatever that is, because without that, you've got a business that just has no value, and you're going to end up shutting the doors.
Well, you are, and so many people, I'm sure you see this a lot, go into business, they aren't thinking about that at all. They're thinking about how they're going to build their business. They're thinking about where they're going to get customers. How are they going to keep margins as high as possible? Where are they going to find their employees? Mm-hmm. All of those kinds of things. And you are doing such an important thing, getting them to focus on the planning up front because of the disasters that can happen when they don't do the planning.
Mm-hmm. I think we talked about earlier where to plan this out really correctly, you need to start off, and particularly if you're going to sell this business, you need to start thinking ahead by 10 years or so, because you have to get this business ready. There's steps to take where you're going to maximize the value of this company to be saleable. And I believe there's only two reasons why you should be running a business. One is to provide a good lifestyle for you and your family. And two is to have a saleable asset at the end of the day that's going to take you through your retirement. And that's not an easy thing. That takes a lot of planning to do. If it's going to be your kids, you've got to figure out how they're going to get along, how that structure is going to be, because there's very few companies that actually survive that second generation because there is no plan, don't you think?
I do. I think that exactly. And I think that so many times, because there's no plan, the second generation comes in and either somebody's very enthusiastic and they don't know the first thing about the business. Well, that's the best way to run a business into the ground. Right. Or they feel like they're stuck with it and they resent having to have this business and they're angry because their parent didn't set up another vehicle for them to get money. They didn't set up the company in a way that it could be sold, and you know, nobody's happy with that, and that's not going to be a successful business either. And you say, and we did talk about 10 years. 10 years is a good, it's a really good measuring stick, because when you start that process, giving yourself 10 years gives you the opportunity to carefully evaluate whether your family is the right successors or not, whether you need to bring in other people as, you know, other internal candidates, or whether what you need to do is position the business to sell it to somebody else. It takes a number of years to get financials in the shape that they need to be in order to maximize the value of your business if you go to sell it.
And also, you've got to be able to take yourself out of the picture. Otherwise, you're going to sell this business, and what's so common is that, okay, I'll buy your business, but you're staying here for the next 5 years to run this thing until we kind of wean you out of here. Generally, that's not what you're thinking when it comes to when you're ready to cash the chips in. You don't want to be sticking around there for 5 years.
No, you don't. And in fact, a lot of those situations where they say you'll stick around for 5 years, they don't work out very well.
Right.
Especially the situations where they say, tell you what we'll do. We'll buy your company and we're going to pay you $2 million. Except we're only going to pay you $1 million when we buy it. The other the other half of that $2 million is going to be earned out by you over that 5 year period. Mm-hmm. And those kinds of situations fail more often than I can tell you. Because number one, the guy selling the business is looking to get checked out. Number two, he's never had a boss that he had to answer to other than himself. And so now he's got to do something somebody else's way. Number three, the kinds of things he used to do aren't allowed anymore. There's all kinds of problems. And especially when the purchasing entity that comes in is a bigger business and they got a bunch of bean counters running the way things are done, that can be very aggravating for the legacy business owner who was hoping to get the other half of the value of his company out of this earnout kind of provision. So again, that's all part of planning ahead and positioning the company in such a way that as a seller, you can say, no, I'm in a better position than to let you give me this earnout thing. I want you to pay me the value of the company. And then I'll go away, and you can bring your people in. It's your company. You can do whatever you want to with it.
And that's exactly how they did those roll-ups back in the mid-90s. I took a look at those, and once they said, here's the keys to your new Taurus, the Mercedes, country club, expense account, all that stuff, that's out of here. And that's how they made the numbers work with all the add-backs. But most of those blew up when the economy turned. But it's tough to be able to sell your business and then just walk away. So you've got to do some real planning for that. Let's get into that fourth D, which is disability. Not many people think about this. They're always focused on having life insurance, which most everybody should have. But very few people have disability insurance. And statistically, it's way out there. It's something like you have 10 times more likelihood of becoming disabled than you do from actually dying. And I know so many people in the roofing business, whether they fell off a ladder and they're paralyzed or whatever it is. Disability insurance is something I think is critical for anybody in this business. And it's expensive, but there's a reason why it's expensive. It happens. And if you become disabled or your partner becomes disabled, what are you going to do? That's something that I think so few contractors think about. It can kill your business.
Well, it can, and too few contractors and other business owners think about the disability aspect of things. In a lot of ways, it's worse than if your partner dies, because the disabled partner, you know, is looking for money to come out of the company and has always been paid a salary and everything else and distributions. But so now they're disabled, and so they're looking for that money, but they're not contributing to the business because they can't.
Right.
And so, you know, not only as the non-disabled partner, not only are you looking at having all this money keep going out, but then, you know, you have to hire somebody else to replace, you know, your disabled partner for what they're doing. You have to spend a lot more time bringing them up to speed. You're drawn away from the things that you've been focusing on. It can be a real, real problem. And disability insurance, yes, it's expensive, but it's something that you need to consider and put into this shareholder agreement or LLC operating agreement, into your buy-sell provisions. Talk about disability. Talk about what's going to constitute a disability. How are you going to measure that? Is it so many months? Is there a doctor's prognosis and diagnosis that you have to deal with? You know, what's the definition of when somebody becomes disabled? And then, is the insurance going to be the full payment? Is there other money that the company is going to pay out? Is there some notion of, well, you're still, as a disabled partner, you're entitled to your distributions of profits, except out of your distributions, we're going to take the salary and other expenses of the people that we had to hire to replace you. You know, those are kinds of things that you need to integrate into the plan and put down on paper and just deal with these issues up front when there's a time that you can deal with them. Because if you wait until somebody falls off that ladder and has a serious injury, then it's too late.
Exactly. Well, Scott, in wrapping this up, most contractors go out of business because they're just not charging enough money. So it tends to be a slow and painful death. But these four Ds that we covered, those can happen in the blink of an eye. But it's something you can prepare for. So, Scott, can you tell us how we can get some more information from you?
Well, I'm happy to. First of all, your listeners here, I've got to be totally depressed hearing you talk about how their business is going to die and all of these devastating things. Let me put a different spin on it. Let me tell your listeners that what we've been talking about are ways that you can protect and preserve the business from potential issues that you can avoid if you just simply take the direct and upfront approach of doing proper planning and consider the issues that have to be addressed and put them in place. And once they're in place, then you can focus on proper pricing, proper marketing measures, hiring the right people, and otherwise building your business. As a lawyer, what I try to do is I try to help my clients figure out how to put in place the structures, the documents that they need in order to protect them, in order to help them be more productive, more successful in their business. I'm easy to get a hold of. That email is SDC, like Sam David Charlie, at HP HPSSlaw.com. And the HPSS is like Hendrick Phillips Salzman Siegel. And then that is also our website address, HPSSlaw.com. You can go to the website and you can read about our firm, about all the things that we do for contractors, can read about me and my business planning experience, and what we focus on in helping contractors try to make their business as productive and successful as possible.
Well, Scott, you were right. I was bumming myself out there. So I appreciate you lightening the mood up a little bit. But your firm was who we were with for 20 years, and you guys did a great job for us. But I want to put in a plug for your retainer program that you have at the firm. And this is a great program where it's an inexpensive way to get good advice on all your contracts. It's a low-cost way to keep you out of trouble on a lot of these jobs. So I recommend that our listeners check that out, get hold of Scott, check out the website, and take a look at this because it's a great program. Highly recommend it. But Scott, I really appreciate you coming on the show today. This is some great information that I've been wanting to have this interview for a long time because this is some great information that contractors really need to understand. So let's be in touch, and I appreciate it very much.
We'll be in touch, and thank you again, Dave. I really enjoyed the opportunity to be with you, and I'm hopeful that your listeners will gain something out of this and understand, you know, the value of good and careful planning.
It's what the show is all about. So you take care. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Dave.
That's it for today's show. If you want to get a copy of my one-page business plan, where you can create a professional business plan in just a few hours, go to theroofershow.com, where you can download it for free. Simply answer the questions, fill in the PDF, and print. Short and sweet. And as always, thanks for listening. I really appreciate it, and we'll see you next week on The Roofer Show.